From macOS Catalina, this is Gui Rambo, and this is Stack Trace. And I have, as always with me, my good friend, John Sandel. Where are you from, John?
I am still in the Mojave Desert. I was left behind in the desert. I haven't migrated to the wonderful land of Catalina just yet. You know, it took me like, I don't know, 3 or 4 months before I actually upgraded to Mojave. So I'm not really in the mood to install a beta version of macOS on my machine at the moment.
Let me give people a disclaimer. Even though I am running the beta on what I consider to be my main machine, which is my Pro laptop, I definitely do not recommend this. I do have a second Mac I can resort to if anything goes wrong here. So please don't do it.
That's a good disclaimer. I mean, it depends on which kind of situation you're in, right? And if you really want to experiment with some of the new features, or if you want to live on the edge, if you will, that could be great. But it's usually good to have some kind of backup, either to install Catalina or any beta version on like a separate partition, or to use a separate machine like you're doing. For me, I am always like in production mode when I'm in front of my Mac. Like, I always have stuff to do. So I don't feel like I have, you know, any kind of spare time or energy to explore a beta version of macOS. I'm more than happy to install betas and explore them of iOS. But on the Mac, I just want to get work done. And that's why I keep with the stable versions. And I'm even conservative when it comes to upgrading to a new stable version.
What you're saying is you're not a thrill seeker.
I'm not a thrill seeker. I am very much I'm a comfort seeker. So what have you been up to, Rambo, since you came back from WWDC, which wasn't that long ago?
Yeah, I arrived yesterday. Yesterday was Monday as record, and I had just spent pretty much an entire day traveling. Turns out San Francisco is quite far from Florianopolis. Go figure.
Who could have known? It turns out that the Earth is round, right? And vertical distances are as long as horizontal distances.
Yeah, so basically an entire day flying. I mean, in between flying and connections, and all my layovers were kind of short, so I optimized my flying time, I guess. But yeah, quite tired, but not much time to rest because I went straight back to work, fixing some issues in a part-time job and also starting to develop a roadmap for what I'm working on now that we have the new stuff and it has to be done by September, my new stuff regarding the new betas. So yeah, lots of work and been exploring the betas as well, which has been fun and full of issues as well.
Awesome. Yeah, this year is particularly busy for almost anyone who ships any kind of apps on any of Apple's platforms, especially if you're on iOS or if you want to bring that app to the Mac, if you want to start adopting some of the new frameworks, etc. But even just like keeping up with things, I feel like this is a particularly busy year, especially if you haven't been doing any form of work when it comes to dark mode or themes. There's could be a lot of work there to be done to make your colors and things like that more dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, every year, this is also true, like just making your app compile on the new Xcode can be a lot of work depending on if it's like a huge project with lots of dependencies. It can be hard to just like make it build and run from the new Xcode. And that's quite true this year from what I've seen from some projects of people I know and at least one project I'm involved with, which is one of those huge apps with lots of legacy. So yeah, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, absolutely. Even just like Xcode settings and things like that can at a certain point get problematic when it comes to upgrading to a new version. So my regular advice about this is just to start as early as possible and to try to do like parallel continuous integration and testing with both Xcode 11 and Xcode 10 at the same time. So you don't have to maintain like an Xcode 11 branch for like months and months, because that's going to be a lot of work. Like, I usually want to try to get everything into master as much as I can and to add maybe some specific code paths for handling some deprecations or some removed APIs or stuff or things like that. But as much as I can, I want to get things into master so I can just have one code base to work on.
the tricky aspect about that is that you need to migrate your project to the new Xcode while still making sure it can build with the old one, because you need to ship binaries to the App Store and you can't ship from beta Xcode. You can ship to test flight just fine, but not to the App Store. So that's like, it's very tricky. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, it is very tricky. And sometimes it's almost impossible, but as much as I can, I'd like to do that. And sometimes you can do that with, you can write your own small little shims, or you can add some extensions that you only compile if you're compiling with Xcode 11, etc. Like, there are a couple of different techniques that we can go into more in detail if our listeners want us to on future episodes, how to deal with multiple versions of Xcode, because it is a really interesting topic. But yeah, it's definitely one of those things where you want to start as early as possible, like not like a few days before September. It's like, oh, maybe I should try with Xcode 11.
Yeah. So, John, I was going to ask, what have you been up to? But I know what you've been doing. And you've been doing this new website, WWDC by Sandell, which was quite of an experiment to put out with your new static site generation stuff. I've had people ask me at WWDC, I mean, at AltConf and stuff, when is John open sourcing the static site thing? It's awesome. So, John, please tell us, give us a retrospective of your website work with WWDC by Sandell.
Sure, I'd love to. So I will be posting a full technical retrospective. Perhaps even it will be out by the time this episode airs. We'll see. But regardless, it's going to be out sometime this week at www.dcbysandell.com, where I'm going to go through running the website, like from the beginning, what my goals were, how I made it happen, how I built the site, and also what the outcomes were. So like a little bit of a retrospective, both in terms of how it went and how the website was received by the community and things like that, but also from a technical point of view, like how I managed to build this site this way and the number of requests it handled and how that went, and all those details will be in there. So look forward for that soon. If not already, by the time you hear this, then soon. So to give you a little mini retrospective here, it went definitely way above my expectations in many different regards. Like you mentioned, Rambo, it was a little bit of a experiment, both in terms of how can I build and launch like a separate website that is not Swift by Sandell and that is not hosted by Squarespace, which I'm currently using. Like, how can I do that on my own? And also, to try this new tech stack, which was both doing the site as a static site, which I was generating using this new tool that I'm working on, and also using both Linode as my hosting provider and Cloudflare as a CDN to kind of power that whole stack. That was all like a big experiment. And it worked really well. Like the site was up all the time. It was zero downtime. I think on the last episode, we mentioned that the peak CPU usage was 1.1% or something. Was that right, Rambo?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the overall top that it reached during that whole two-week period was 1.7. So nice. That was very nice. And the cache rates, like, once you republish a new version of the site, like, I invalidate the Cloudflare cache so that Cloudflare needs to go to my server to get all the content again, and then it will sometimes use a little bit more CPU, but still very, very little in the grand scheme of things. But after a little while, after that was happening and all the different Cloudflare servers had gotten that new content cached, then the cache rates were like in the 19 percentile, like 95%, 96% of all requests being cached on Cloudflare. So this whole architecture worked out really, really well.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I also showed you, we use Cloudflare as a proxy for the WWDC app for macOS. We basically talk directly to Apple's API, but we use Cloudflare as a proxy so we can change like the endpoint, because they change the endpoint every now and then, and we don't want to have to update the app to change the endpoint.
Right.
So we use Cloudflare as a proxy and might as well enable caching. And we served millions of requests through that cache, and it was also like lots of caching going on, and many gigabytes of data cached, and all just JSON. Like, the videos are not, we don't proxy those. Those are directly from Apple, but just JSON data. It was gigabytes.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, once you reach a certain scale, like, even a small JSON file, I know that the JSON responses from those APIs that you mentioned are not really small, right? So they are quite big. But still, like, even just HTML, CSS, JSON, like, these files that we think of as very lightweight, once you start doing the numbers, and you have, like, I think throughout the 2 weeks, I had over 2 million requests to the site. You know, we're talking gigabytes and gigabytes of data of like HTML. You know, it's really crazy. So the Cloudflare part was part of why the site was so fast. And one thing that made me really happy was just how many people were remarking about not only the content of the site, but just how fast it was. And that it felt like, you know, back in the day in the 90s or something, when websites were simple and fast, like, it felt like going back to that. And this was very much my goal, if you will. Like, I wanted to make a modern website that looks nice, that has all the nice little features, like, you know, links and nice colors and fonts, but
even some images.
Even some images, right?
So fancy.
Exactly, so fancy. But zero JavaScript, like, not a single line of JavaScript was on the site. And just rendered old school with CSS, with all the modern new CSS 3 features and things like that you can actually now use in all the browsers, and just make a nice looking website that is just crazy fast. That was the goal. And I'm really happy that a lot of people seem to appreciate like all the effort that went into building the site.
Yeah, and some people are like, well, of course it's super fast. It's just HTML and CSS. Yeah, exactly. But that's how the entire web should be. And unfortunately, it's kind of like privacy. Every company and every app and everyone should care about privacy. But unfortunately, we are at a stage where caring about privacy is like a differentiating factor when you're talking about a company. And I think it's the same for websites and being fast. Having a fast, static website that's good these days is a special thing when it should be just the norm.
Yeah, totally. And speaking of privacy, like, those things really go hand in hand. Yeah. Like, a lot of the reason why the web is so slow is because there's this ad tech everywhere, right? There's these JavaScript frameworks that people drop in. You know, they might want to have like a login with Facebook button, and they include that Facebook JavaScript file from their server. And it just like ends up like analyzing the whole site and really like slowing things down. And there's a lot of other kinds of these SDKs that people use for analytics or for, you know, some kind of tracking or for ads and things like that. And I just didn't want any of that stuff on my site. Like, I just wanted things to be super simple and respectful of user privacy, respectful of users' time. Like, I don't want people to have to sit and look at a loading spinner when they go to my website. I just want them to punch in the URL, hit enter, and boom. That's the website, right? Like, I was making this joke earlier last week. I was saying that I wish that instead of like modern web developers and web designers spending so much time like designing and implementing fancy loading spinners, it would be great if they would spend that time building fast websites instead, so you don't need loading spinners.
That's true, right?
Yeah, so yeah, that's you'll probably hear me do these like little mini rants about the modern web, because I do have some opinions about this, but I realize not every website can be as simple as the one I made, but a lot of websites I think can, because a lot of the things that we do on the internet is like read articles or read content, look at images and things like that. So I don't think everything needs to be like a React web app. I think you can just go back to basics and build something simple. And that's what I want to do. And I'm just very happy that it worked out so well.
Yeah. And also, we're not saying you can't build a React web app that's great and loads quickly. I don't know. You probably can. And just as an example, like, the platform we use to record this podcast, which is Cast, trycast, the website, it's quite fast. And I bet there's a ton of JavaScript behind it, because it's freaking recording audio and uploading it to a server. So there must be some JavaScript involved.
You can't do that with CSS yet.
Not yet. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And absolutely. Like, sometimes when I say like, oh, it's 100% JavaScript free, and, you know, I talk about JavaScript like this, you might get the impression that I like hate JavaScript and I think it should be just removed from every website. I really don't. Like, I think definitely JavaScript has its place, and there's a lot of functionality, like you mentioned, Rambo, that you can't do without it, and that's fine. The thing I'm maybe quote-unquote against, or the thing I would like to see maybe reduced, it's just this overuse of JavaScript or this overuse of these super dynamic websites that I don't feel like has to be so dynamic. And for web developers to maybe consider a little bit more, employing more like more aggressive caching, to do more things server-side or statically so that things can be more faster for the user. Because I think a lot of times the reason that these technologies are so are working the way they work is not really because the website needs it. It's because the development experience kind of requires it. That the frameworks that people use, these JavaScript frameworks, is because they want to have a nice developer experience, not because the end result is necessarily better.
Absolutely. And we're going to talk more about this in a second when we talk about Swift UI.
Yeah.
Which is a way to improve developer experience while maintaining user experience.
Fantastic.
But before, we forgot about something on the last episode.
Yeah, we have some debts to settle here. Yeah, there are some things that have been left unsettled. And we're, of course, talking about our poker results. We were so excited the last episode. We were talking about all the new things from WWDC. We had a lot of fun. And then at the end, when we had stopped recording, and I realized I was walking away from my microphone, and it just hit me. We didn't talk about the poker results.
Yeah.
So let's do that right now. Let's go through them really quick and then reveal the end score. So both of us did well. I will say it was extremely even. In fact, the person who won by only 1 point, Rambo. Ooh. Only 1 point. So it's going to be a very, very exciting one. So let's go through the bets very quickly. The first one was that we think there would be a new iPad undo gesture on the keyboard. Like you could undo on the iPad using a new kind of gesture. And you bet 3 on that, I bet 2, and it happened. So we both won those points.
Just a reminder that everything we mentioned has to appear in the keynote. So
that's right. Yeah, it has to be on the keynote. It's not only that it can be in iOS or it can be in the end product. It needs to have been shown on stage in the keynote. The next item is that the Mac Pro would be shown, and we both put down 4 points for that, and it happened, so there you go. The next one was about a professional Apple-made display will be shown. Also, we both won those points, and that was 4 for you, Rambo, and 3 for me. The next one was multi-window and document support on the iPad. We both put down 5 points for that, and it did happen. So you see, so far so good, right? We're getting these scores. It's going well for us here. The next thing was a little bit less successful for us, and that was that we thought that new background tasks APIs for iOS would be shown. But that didn't happen, so I lost 1 point, and you, Rambo, lost 3 points there.
Now, John, should we maybe do a revision afterwards and check the word cloud slides, or did you check those?
I did check those briefly, but I will admit that they could be like because they were on, everything was so fast, right?
Yeah.
So they could have been like a little camera angle that I missed or something, but I think we should do what they do on Upgrade, which is where we've been inspired from this, which is that points award on the show are final.
Okay, all right.
You think that's fair?
Yeah, I'm going to accept that.
Okay, cool. Moving on, that was number 5, so we're halfway through. The next one was that we would see a desktop class browser, a version of Safari on the iPad, and we did. And I put down 5 points and Rambo 4, so I got 5 and Rambo 4 there.
Damn.
Next one, yeah, too bad. Next one was about mouse support, and this did happen. Like, there's now mouse pointer support on iOS, which is really exciting, but it wasn't shown during the keynote, so I put down -2 for that, so that was great for me. I got 2 points, but you, Rambo, you lost 2 there. I'm sorry. The next was that the iPad can be used as a second monitor for the Mac, which is now known as Sidecar, or it was all along known as Sidecar, right?
That's funny, yeah, that they use the same name.
Yeah. I got 4 points there, Rambo got 5. The next one, the penultimate one, was that ARKit would get significant new features and improvements, and we both got 3 points for that. And finally, this was my dream bet, which unfortunately didn't happen, Xcode for iPad. I lost 3 points. And Rambo, your check there, your 0 points, it did pay off. So you didn't win or you didn't lose any points there.
Should have put -5 for that one.
Yeah, you should have, because that might have changed the outcome. Because now if we sum up all the points, we end up with, drum roll, Rambo got 23 points. So, pretty good. Like, very good. It, much better than the year when we got, like, -5 or something like that. When we were dreaming too much. And then I got... Are you ready, Rambo? I got 24 points.
Oh.
So, I'm sorry. I win.
All right. So, yeah. I owe you a dinner.
All right. Thank you. I'm looking forward to that. And I'm happy about this victory. I'm also happy that it was so even. Like, it was just 1 point between us. So we both did really great. And I'm looking forward to eating some fancy, nice dinner the next time we see each other.
Oh, it has to be fancy.
Of course. You got a really fancy dinner in Italy for your last victory. I expect the same.
That's true. Yeah, it even had truffles and stuff.
There you go. There you go.
All right. So, John, we have to talk about something.
We do.
Yeah, it's a new technology. It's exciting and everyone is talking about it. So we are going to talk about it as well. But of course, we are a developer show, so we need to go a little bit deeper. And of course, I'm talking about Swift UI.
Yeah.
So John, why don't you introduce the subject? How long has this been in the works, by the way?
So Swift UI is not a new thing. It's been in the works at Apple for a long, long time. And when it was released, a lot of people started drawing parallels to technologies like Flutter from Google or React Native from Facebook. And these are also frameworks that are very much the same in nature in terms of how the API is structured. And I'm talking about here this declarative syntax and these declarative APIs where, as developers, we're no longer specifying all the different rendering steps, like saying set the background color to this or move this item 2 pixels to the left or right. We're more specifying what we want the end result to be. Like here we want a button, here we want a label, here we want a list, etc. And then the system kind of takes all those instructions that have been declared and then renders them for us. So when a lot of people saw these, they started drawing parallels to these other declarative technologies. And I saw a lot of comments that, oh, Apple is just reacting to this, or Apple is just like reacting to this latest trend that happened in the last 6 months. And it's the same as we hear when people talk about that, you know, Apple was trying to get Touch ID working under the screen like 2 months before the iPhone is released or something, right? Like.
Yeah.
Apple has long lead times for many things that they do for good reasons, because think about something like Swift UI. You know, it has to be integrated in Xcode, in the system, in iOS, macOS, tvOS, and watchOS. You know, we're talking about a huge effort here involving hundreds, if not thousands of engineers, like huge effort. This is not something that you whip together in 3 months. Like, it just doesn't happen. So
I'm going to disagree on the hundreds, perhaps thousands of engineers, because Apple is known to have small teams for projects, but I do definitely agree on the lead times.
Yeah, I just mean like maybe not thousands, maybe I'm exaggerating there, but I just mean that this work has touched a lot of people in Apple.
It's a huge effort, yeah.
Right, yeah, and it has affected, even if there hasn't been like 100 people contributing code to Swift UI, I'm sure that there's a lot of people who've had to take that into consideration as they've been building and designing other parts of the different systems and the developer tools.
Definitely.
So judging by some tweets that we'll put a link to in the show notes, it seems like Swift UI has been in the works for over 3 years, which is quite a long time. And Combine, which is the framework that you use as a kind of data partner to Swift UI, where you can reactively construct data flows, just like you would do with something like RxSwift.
Hi, Casey.
That has been in work for 6 years. Like, that is before even Swift was a thing. Like, this is pretty crazy to think of that these ideas and these frameworks and these code bases have been in the works for such a long time.
Yeah, that's true. And again, it's so funny because I've seen this talked about a lot. Like, oh, now everyone is writing apps using Flutter, so Apple is scared, so they are doing something to protect themselves. No.
I mean, I'm sure that some of these other technologies, especially React Native, which is a little bit older than Flutter, influence kind of how high of a priority this became, right? Like, even though it's been in the works for years, it's a pretty high chance that it was accelerated in the last couple of years. Maybe not as a direct just like reaction to React Native, reaction to React, huh? But maybe just as a like, okay, this is a thing that developers want, let's put some real effort behind it.
Absolutely. And something that I heard some other podcasts talk about and people commenting on with regards to SwiftUI was this SwiftUI versus Catalyst thing, which it doesn't really make sense because you can write a SwiftUI Catalyst app. They're not opposing technologies. So if you have an iOS app, for an iPad app that you want to port to the Mac that's written with traditional UI kit, you can check the Mac checkbox and that becomes also a Mac app. And at the same time, you can also have an iPad app that's written using Swift UI and also check the checkbox and it becomes a Catalyst app. So I don't think Swift UI and Catalyst are a dichotomy. They're not like either these or the other thing. they are companions in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And there seems to be a certain type of developer who basically just wants the question answered of what should I use, right? Like, which framework should I use? Just tell me, which one should I use? Catalyst, UIKit, AppKit, SwiftUI, which one should I use? And I understand that. Like, I don't think that everyone who is an iOS or Mac developer or any kind of developer needs to be like super interested in all these different things and dive into all of them and dissect them and understand how they work. Some people just want to get their job done, and I totally understand that. But unfortunately, the answer is not as simple as you say, Rambo. Like, you can't just say Catalyst versus Swift UI because they are very much complementary technologies. And I've also seen a lot of people who have the opinion that now writing UIKit is like a waste of time, or writing AppKit code is a waste of time. Like, everything should be moved to Swift UI. And I don't think that's necessarily healthy either. Of course, it depends on the project. If you are starting a new app today and you know that you're going to ship it after September and you're only going to support iOS 13, and you also want to live on the bleeding edge using a brand new framework that hasn't really been tested much in production at scale yet, then go for it. Like, use Swift UI. That's great. But I think there's still so much room for both existing apps and new apps to use UIKit and AppKit and all these different technologies, or Catalyst if you want to bring it to the Mac. Because why throw away all that code that you already have? If you already have a working UI on iOS and you want to bring that to the Mac, why not use Catalyst for that? You might start rewriting some things in Swift UI or complement it, but don't throw away your working code. It's so sad to see that because, you know, this code is working. It can be shipped to users. Users will be happy with this code. Just ship that code, and then you can start working towards a Swift UI future in the future.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, using Swift UI now is kind of like adopting Swift 1.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So it's like I said, it's a brand new technology. What I am going to say though is, if you're thinking about writing a watch app, I would say go for watchOS 6 and start with Swift UI because I really feel like the WatchKit API, it wasn't ever good to begin with, in my opinion, and in many other people's opinions. And I think that's, if you're writing WatchKit now, that's basically writing deprecated code right away because Swift UI is so much more powerful than WatchKit. And you can create different experiences that weren't possible with WatchKit. So if you are writing a watchOS app, I wouldn't support watchOS 5 and below. I would go directly to watchOS 6 and start with Swift UI. If you already have a big watch app that uses WatchKit, then maybe keep working on that one because throwing away code is almost never a good idea.
Yeah, gradually migrating to something new is usually the way to go, at least for me. And I understand that there are edge cases here, and you might have like crazy legacy code that no one on the team understands, and this is a opportunity to maybe rewrite some of that, and that's totally understandable. But I think what both of us are saying is that there's usually a path where you can start adopting some of the new technologies without throwing everything away, especially Swift UI, because it's fully compatible with UIKit and AppKit. You can use, on iOS, you can use a UI hosting controller to bring any Swift UI view hierarchy into UIKit. You can add it as a child view controller or present it as its own modal screen or, you know, whatever you need to do. And the same thing is true for your UIKit views. You can wrap them in a UI view representable implementation, which can then be plugged into a Swift UI view hierarchy. So there's compatibility both ways. So there's really no need to start rewriting things, at least not day one. But you do bring up a great point there, Rambo, with WatchKit. And James Thompson, who I talked to on Swift by Sundell last week, he said the same thing. Like, he basically said that once he's going to start adopting Swift UI, his plan is to start with the watch. Because WatchKit was more limited, but also it's interesting because I think Swift UI conceptually actually has quite a lot in common with WatchKit, in that WatchKit was also quite declarative. It was more limited, but it was also kind of declarative.
Yeah, and what I heard is that Swift UI started as a project for the watch, and then it grew to become something for all of Apple's platforms. I want to go back to what you mentioned, the UI hosting controller, that you can embed Swift UI in an iOS scenario, UIKit scenario. Well, basically, there's no such thing as a Swift UI app just yet. If you write an app using Swift UI in Xcode with the template, what it does is it creates a scene for your app that basically sets a UI hosting controller as the root view controller of your app's window. So every Swift UI quote-unquote app is a UIKit app in iOS.
Which means that it's also an Objective-C app. Which is funny because a lot of people have been now saying that, oh, with Swift UI, you can write a pure Swift app. Well, not really. Not yet. It's going to take a while, long time for Objective-C to completely be gone.
Yeah, and this is interesting because it's Swift UI is, in a sense, backed by either UIKit or AppKit or whatever, but it doesn't have to be that way, and we don't have to worry about that. I mean, currently, we kind of do because there's a lot that's not available in Swift UI yet, so you end up having to wrap UI views and S views in Swift UI stuff for the moment. I'm gonna use an example of, because I'm kind of having to make these decisions as we speak and as this stuff gets released. We have this app called Apple Observer. Do you like it, John?
Oh, I love it. It's my favorite app. I love these notifications that I'm getting from it. I feel great because I know that there's a new beta coming before anyone else except you, a few other people, and Apple knows.
Exactly. So it's this app we use at 9to5 to track iOS beta releases and some other stuff. And currently, if you run this app on your iOS device, it's a blank window with a text saying nothing to be seen here. This app is just for notifications. So all it does is it registers itself with a server to get notifications about new beta. And you get a notification an hour before a beta goes out and when a beta goes out. So I have the UI for this app designed in Sketch already. It is going to have an actual UI, but it hasn't been implemented yet. And I am considering strongly implementing this UI using Swift UI, since this app is soon only going to run on iOS 13 and up. And in fact, I already have a Catalyst version of this app running, but it's still the nothing to be seen here version. there's an example of a decision. Like, this is an app that I don't have the UI written yet, and I'm not planning to support previous OS versions, so I am strongly considering going with Swift UI, or at least using Swift UI considerably.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, absolutely. There's always going to be use cases for it, and wherever you can find a suitable way to use it, you know, in a way that is responsible for the project and also makes sense business-wise to roll out only on iOS 13. That's awesome. Like, I think almost everyone in the whole Swift community right now is like, wants to use Swift UI, me included and you included. Like, we all want to use it. It's just about finding that right place to use it, which for many people might just be like a hobby project or just like playing around with it right now and not like a real app, but just for learning. And that's fine as well. Like, we should all just like take the time that is needed to learn this technology and not just like rush into it right away, I think.
Yeah. So a topic about Swift UI that is hot right now, and it's funny because there's this brand new way to write apps, so there are all these low-hanging fruits around about like what architecture should I use and how do I don't know, load remote images from a URL, which, by the way, Apple should have solved with Swift UI. I'm kind of sad that they didn't, but yeah, foul feedback. So John, what do you think about the way Swift UI works and what sort of architecture do you think we're working with? Because I am a little bit confused still. I don't know what architecture it is I should be writing and how best to decouple views from their data and things like that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And like you say, I think there's a lot of room for innovation here and a lot of different ideas. My way of looking at it is kind of like what we've essentially done here, or what Apple has done, and what we're looking at here is a more quote-unquote traditional MVC. Like, Apple's version of MVC that we've had so far was a little bit strongly centered around view controllers. And I know this is something we've been debating a lot as a community for the last, like, I don't know, 10 years, where it's like, oh, the view controllers are too big, massive view controllers, et cetera, et cetera. But they were very centered around view controllers. A lot of APIs were on top of UI view controller, a lot of system integration and things like that. So the view controller was kind of the center of the universe in a sense, where it was talking to the model and it was talking to the view. And you could have controller objects, and Apple also has their own controller objects as well that are not view controllers, but they contain logic and they can speak to a view controller, for example. I tend to call those logic controllers or model controllers, and we can put links to two articles that are written on those topics in the show notes. And that's kind of how I'm looking at Swift UI. I'm looking at, we have MVC, we still have views, we have models, and we have controllers, but we don't have view controllers anymore. So the views themselves are rendering, like they are responsible for the rendering, and you inject either a model, like an observable model, or you can inject a controller into those view declarations. And that way you can have like your data controllers and your model controllers and logic controllers in there that can make the decisions. So that way you can still have that nice separation of concerns, and you can unit test those controllers in isolation without the UI, and then have the UI just draw from those and use those as the decision makers. So that's one way of looking at it. But I'm sure there's also 1,000 other ways that we're going to both discover and talk about and these kind of things. So what do you think about my interpretation of this, Rambo?
I think it makes sense. One particular subject I am kind of passionate about when designing, when architecting iOS apps. And full disclaimer, I've only been using Swift UI for like a few hours. So
you're an expert at this point, right?
So I haven't really found still a way that I'm happy with to handle navigation in Swift UI. Because the way Apple shows it in their sample code, and the way I'm doing it on my little test sample project I'm working on, is like, let's say I have, so my test project, it uses the Unsplash API and it downloads a list of images based on a topic. So a topic can be like Apple or flowers or iPhone. So I have this list of topics, and when I tap one, I want to go to another scene, another view in my app. It would be a view controller in the old days. And I want to load pictures about that topic. So the way Apple tells you to do this in their documentation is to like wrap the list item, so like the iPhone item, in a navigation button. And from there, you will say that the destination is a detail view, for instance, with the topic iPhone. And that's coupling the list of topics with the way you, what happens when you tap a topic. And I don't like that. For me, it's like pushing a view controller from another view controller directly. But I'm probably thinking about this in the old way. So yeah, I'm not sure. But I need to find a way to not be doing navigation directly in like the list of topics, because that's a list of topics. It doesn't know what should happen when you tap a topic.
Yeah. I think that there's a lot of confusion right now, which is understandable because it's so new, right? And I'm definitely not claiming that I know everything and that I've figured it all out.
And I fully admit that I'm completely confused.
Right. And I think I am too. Everyone is. Like, we've just seen this now for a few days. Like, it's a week or something now at the time of recording. This is nothing, right? Like, a week is nothing in terms of getting into a brand new framework. So there's going to be still a lot of, you know, debate, and we're going to have to figure things out. But one thing I think that a lot of people have been especially confused around is like a little bit around the sample code that Apple has shown. And like you mentioned, they are showing like add a navigation button, do the navigation in line, just create the new view, like the new scene in line in a closure, and just keep nesting things. And you end up with this like almost pyramid of doom, right? Where like there's these like closures and like closures and closures. And I saw a lot of people also commenting on that, like, oh, it looks like you can't write Swift UI without writing a pyramid of doom. And I think that when you look at sample code that Apple is publishing, or any kind of sample code,
It's tutorial code.
It's trying to tell a story. It's trying to prove a point. You shouldn't really just like copy those things and put them in your app, because they are just there to show something. And I think Apple has done a fantastic job with the documentation and the sample code for Swift UI. I think it looks great. And for teaching the concepts, I think that's fantastic, like to put everything in line. Because imagine the opposite. Imagine if they would start putting like model and logic controllers and coordinators and move this to a factory in there. Like, a beginner looking at that would be a lot more confused, I'll tell you that, you know?
Because, and we are all beginners.
Right, exactly. Because you want to have something that is streamlined, that is showing one thing at a time. So when you're looking at some of the sample code, I think you need to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt and to look at the overall concepts rather than just the exact implementation. So to answer your kind of question, or what you were thinking about there, from my point of view, it's quite simple the way I see it, where since you have a navigation button, this navigation button has a closure. It's just a function, which means that this function can come from anywhere. You can define it inline if you're doing something simple, or you can pass it in from somewhere else. So if you want to have a list that is completely unaware of what it's presenting when the navigation button is tapped, you can pass those actions in. And I will plug another one of my articles here, which is extracting actions from view controllers, which is exactly the same thing, is that try to move view controller actions into functions that you can then pass in. And the same thing is true here with Swift UI. You can have your list view have a bunch of properties that are functions where you can define what will happen when you click on an item or when some navigation happens. So that's one option. And then the second option is really to, again, have those objects that you inject. So you can inject like a navigator or a logic controller that does the actual navigation, so you can encapsulate that in somewhere else. And then the third option that comes to mind is extracting that navigation button, or maybe the UI that it presents, into a new subview, like a new view type that can then be, for example, a image navigation button in your case, and that can contain all that logic. So your list view does not have to. And I think that's in general like a pattern that a lot of us will need to start fully embracing, is that with Swift UI, you should really try to build as small and lean views as possible. Like, they should not be hundreds of lines. They should be really, really small, because they are all just reusable. You can plug them in anywhere. They're composable. And this is really great. And this also means that you can build smaller items and plug them in anywhere. And there's really no penalty here, because we're not talking about UI views. You're not putting a lot of empty UI views on screen that will get rendered. You're just adding additional struct, additional descriptions of views.
Yeah, I'm going to try out some of those suggestions. I actually, this app I'm making, I plan on putting it on my GitHub, just so people have something to reference. It's probably gonna be, I'm probably gonna be ashamed of it in a few months, but whatever. I remember, I think one of the first apps I've written in Swift is on my GitHub, which is some, I think it was an FTP client or something.
That's
that I
awesome.
Made just to try out Swift 1. So yeah, I'm gonna probably put it on my GitHub so people can have a look at it. And it has my own implementation of downloading remote images, which Apple should have done themselves. But
yeah, there should really be a image with URL initializer. And I'm sure there will be. If not this year, then it that would be like a big applause next year.
We have that on tvOS already. So yeah, there should be something from for all platforms. But John, Swift UI is heavily dependent on some Swift language features, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And would you like to tell us about those and how it integrates with the language?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, maybe now when we're talking, it sounds almost like I'm the expert and you're asking me questions. Like, I really don't want people to get that impression. Like, I'm not saying that I'm a Swift UI expert or anything like that, because like I said before, I'm also learning about this. I've been following this for a while, like with Swift Evolution and these kind of things. So maybe I had a little bit of a head start and I've been diving into these specifics because that's what I'm all about. Like, that's where my interest is in. So that's why we're having this conversation, in case anyone is wondering.
You're more Swifty than me.
That's right. You're more Spelunky. I'm more Swifty. So to answer that, yes, there is a lot of new Swift features coming in Swift 5.1, which are powering Swift UI's API. And one thing I really love about Swift UI in general is that when Apple introduced, or the Swift open source community, I should say, introduced Codable, you know, Swift's own JSON mapping API, that was all done like on the compiler level. So it was implemented in the compiler. There wasn't like a JSON mapper protocol or language feature that anyone could use. It was just for Codable, and it still is. But with Swift UI, we're not talking about like compiler magic here. And I tweeted about this earlier today, and I already started getting some replies that was like, well, it's all compiler magic. But I understand, like,
the entire language is compiler magic.
Right,
if you think
exactly.
About it.
When I say magic, what I mean is, for me, anything that's magic is something that we as third-party developers don't have access to. So something that is private and hidden, that happens, you know, in the dark, that's magic to me. Things that are out in the open, public APIs, they're not really magic because anyone can use them. Anyone can try them. Anyone can try to understand them. So those are different things. And with Swift UI, the entire API, as far as I can tell, maybe with some caveats here and there, is implemented using public Swift 5.1 features. So you have things like, there's this new thing called property wrappers, which used to be called property delegates, which enables you to define essentially like wrappers for your different properties. So in Swift UI, you have this annotation, which is at state, which enables you to define like stateful properties for your views. But those are not like some magic keyword that Apple only can use. It's just delegating or wrapping to a specific property delegate, which is a state type in this case, which does all of that wrapping. So we can write our own property wrappers as well using the exact same tools, which I just find super exciting. And the same thing is true for the other features. You have function builders, which is what they use for the DSL. So you can have the one expression, then the next one on different lines without any additional syntax, and it all builds together into one view hierarchy. You have, you can now omit return keywords. So you can just have these clean looking view implementations. You have the sum keyword, which enables you to use protocols with associated types as if they were concrete types. So there's a bunch of different really cool features in here that are not just for Swift UI, they're for anyone writing Swift programs. And I'm just really excited and happy that they went that direction, because they could have just as easily said, these are some magic keywords, only we can use them, you cannot use them, these cool features are only for Swift UI, but they're not. And that just makes me really happy.
Now, John, I always try to avoid this, but there's a topic in our show notes that I just have to read. And it says, what if I told you that you can make your Swift UI views codable? What?
All right. So Those who have been following me for a few years now, back before Swift by Sundell, before Stacktrace, when I wasn't so out there in the community and publishing stuff, when I was working at Spotify, I was a big fan of declarative views back then, you know, before it was cool, right? That's how hipster I am. but I was at Spotify, I was working on a project to actually build declarative UIs where we could specify the view hierarchy from the backend. So from the backend, we could send a JSON file, and that would then get decoded on the client into native views. So I've been playing around with this, Rambo. I'm still not giving up this idea. Like, I think this idea is awesome. Like, being able to send data that gets automatically translated into views, I think is awesome. Like, I love that. It gives you so much flexibility. So I've done a little experiment where I've made some of my Swift UI views, because they're just structs, right? So I've made them codable. And that way, you can send a JSON from the server, which just includes the data that your struct needs, and you can construct your view completely dynamically from JSON data. How cool is that?
Oh my God. You're crazy, John.
I know.
But that sounds awesome.
It is pretty awesome. I mean, it's not something that comes only with benefits. Having this kind of structure is something you would, of course, need to decide on an app-by-app basis, whether you need it or not. But if you have something that's very content-driven, you know, say something that most developers use web technologies for these days, like displaying a product page or something like that, which needs to be very dynamic, you could theoretically build that with Swift UI and decode your product JSON into fully native Swift UI views automatically. And I just find that super fascinating. Still, like all these years later, since I've been working with this ideas, even back in the Objective-C days, I still find this super fascinating.
Yeah, one thing I've been doing when you mentioned product page, so the company I work part-time for is an e-commerce company. So we do have a product detail page. And I had to rebuild it recently, and it's a complex UI. And one thing I want to try and do is recreate that using Swift UI, because I think it's the type of page, type of view in an app that works great for Swift UI, the way it's laid out as a stack and everything like that. And it's quite a bit of code without Swift UI, so maybe I'll try that and report my results.
Yeah, please do. Now, we, of course, both have a lot to say about Swift UI, as you can tell. Like, I am incredibly excited about it. But we're going to save some more for some future episodes. And also, we do have hashtag AskStackTrace. So if you have any questions about Swift UI, anything in particular you'd like us to talk about, tweet it out to us with hashtag AskStackTrace, and we'll try to answer it on a future episode.
By the way, anything that can be answered without code, because we can't code through a podcast.
Right. We can always put a link in the show notes to some code snippet or something. You know, that works, right? All right. Now we're going to segue into a little bit more of your area, Rambo. We're going to switch from Swift to spelunking. You know, that's a good transition. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor, which is our good friends at WIP Labs. Maybe you've noticed, but each month, 9to5 Mac makes a new exciting deal of the month, which of course you wonderful Stacktrace listeners also get access to, because Stacktrace is part of 9to5 Mac. And this month, we've teamed up with WIP Labs to give you a limited time 15% discount on their new slope stand for iPhone or iPad. Now, this is a beautiful stand. In fact, it's so beautiful that it was featured in the New York Museum of Modern Art's design stores. It's made from brushed and anodized aluminum, just like the iMac and the MacBook Pro, which gives the stand a really nice and clean look. And it's a perfect match for iPhones and iPads that you'll use it with. But it's not only nice to look at, this is an incredibly advanced stand. It uses unique suction technology made from nanofoam with thousands of microscopic air pockets that grip your device, it holds it firmly, and it gives you also that perfect viewing angle on your desk. Now, there's no messy adhesive here, there's no clips, there's no extra things that you need to keep your device attached, which means that you can easily remove and reattach your device whenever you want. The slope stand is available in two sizes. You've got one for iPads, you've got one for iPhones, and I think both our developer and designer friends who are listening to the show, or anyone who does work that requires looking at the end result on actual devices, such as when building an iPhone app, I think you'll all find Whiplab's slope stand to be the perfect desk companion. So, to get that limited time discount on the slope stand, go to whiplabs.com, that is WIPLABS.com right now, to find out more, and then use the offer code 9to5Mac2019 for a 15% discount on the slope stand from Whiplabs. Once again, that's whiplabs.com, and offer code 9to5Mac2019 for 15% off your slope stand. Thanks so much to Whiplabs for sponsoring this episode of StackTrace. All right, so now it's time to do this episode's edition of
The Rambo Report.
So Rambo, I know that you just came home from your trip to California. You haven't had that much time yet to do your spelunking, which I'm sure you're going to do a lot of during the next coming weeks and months. But tell us, what are some of your initial findings from your spelunking of the new betas?
So remember that Apple Tag device?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, that little tile thing, right? You can stick it on anything to track your wallet or something like that.
Exactly. So it showed up on iOS 13.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, so it can be found on iOS 13. There's an asset, one of those assets kind of like they use for the AirPods animation and things like that. There's one of those assets on iOS 13 that uses the device model tag 1,1.
That's pretty obvious. It's almost like, Rambo, please find us, 101.
Yeah, it wasn't me who found it, by the way. I'm sorry, I don't have the name, but we can leave a link in the show notes to the article. But I also found another thing that's like a placeholder image that kind of gives us an idea of what the tag is going to look like, which is basically a circle with the Apple logo, a white circle with the Apple logo.
And do you have any sense of scale when it comes to this asset? Like, or is it just a vector graphic? Like, the actual device could be any scale.
Yeah, it's just like a placeholder mock-up of what it will look like. You absolutely can't infer any size information from this asset. But it does match the description I've been given by people about what this device is going to look like, that it's going to be a circle with the Apple logo, basically. But we can expect it to be quite small, I would say. It's probably very small.
It's probably going to be like so small that they can brag about it, right? Like, because if it would be the same size as the tile, which I think is about the size of like a big coin, right?
Yeah.
Then it would be cool, but it wouldn't be like extremely impressive. But I'm going to guess that it's going to be like just like a centimeter or something in diameter, like very, very small, so that you can just stick it on anything, like even stuff like your car keys.
Yeah, I'm also curious to know what type of attachment it's going to have. Is it going to be magnetic? Is it going to have like a little loop thing so you can put it on a keychain? Is it going to be an adhesive of some kind? Is it going to be all of those things? So that's something I don't know and I'm curious to see. And given, by the way, so the asset that's found on iOS, the tag 1,1 asset, it currently has AirPods video inside of it. So it's clearly a placeholder.
Nice.
Yeah, fortunately for Apple and unfortunately for us, we're going to have to wait a little bit longer to actually see what it looks like. So I'm curious about the attachment types, and given how much stuff is in there and how much people inside of Apple know about this project, I'm going to say that we're probably going to see this announced this September alongside new iPhones. What do you think, John?
That sounds super exciting. And it sounds to be the perfect event for it, right? Because it's a more consumer-focused thing. It doesn't really have a developer story. So it makes total sense for this to be introduced in September, I think.
Now, another thing I happen to know that I haven't talked about on my articles, I think, but there's going to be an AR story to this. So,
ooh, nice.
Yeah. So you're going to be able to like point your iPhone in an environment and it's going to like show you a 3D arrow or something showing you where your stuff is.
That's super cool.
Super exciting. But you know what type of device that would work even better on, John?
What could that be? Maybe something that's on your head?
Glasses.
There you go.
So, yeah, so this is something that would like be super magical to use with AR glasses. But what we heard is that Apple is going to be talking about AR glasses next year. So only 2020, not this year. But recently, it seems that every Apple rumor has been behind by 1 year. Like every time, like last year, oh, Apple is only going to talk about the iOS apps on Mac in 2019, but they talked about it last year.
Right.
And then this declarative UI project is only going to be announced in 2020, and then they announced it this year.
Yeah.
So I think maybe there's a chance we're going to see AR glasses this year. Don't quote me on that, but yeah, I'm smelling something.
Interesting. There's also the angle here where whenever Apple introduces a new kind of form factor, both the iPhone and the Apple Watch are examples of this, they tend to announce them much, much earlier than when they actually ship.
True.
Because they need to seek regulatory approval for these new devices and things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw maybe late this year or early next year a glimpse of the AR glasses, like an actual event showing them, and then shipping later in the year or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like the original iPhone was announced 6 months before. I think the watch was like 3 months, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Some time before. And also because if they announce these AR glasses, they need developers to have time to do stuff for them. And because of that, some people have been saying that, oh, they must announce these at some WWDC. But that's not true. Like, they announced the Apple Watch and it had a developer story, and it was before. I think it was announced before WWDC. So it wasn't announced at WWDC. So that's not a requirement for a new form factor.
Yeah, and they can do something similar next year. They can have like an event in March or something showing the actual device and then saying, probably they will have something like all ARKit apps that are built with Swift UI or something will automatically run on these glasses. I'm sure there's going to be some kind of development story like that, because like we mentioned before on the show, there's something brewing here. There's a reason why they're pushing ARKit so hard. It's not because they expect everyone to hold up their iPhones and iPads like that. There's a bigger story here, for sure. So I'm sure there's going to be something like, and guess what? Day one, there's already going to be so many apps that support out of the box. And then at WWDC, they give you all the tools and the actual, APIs to use if you want to call into these glasses in some other way.
And also RealityKit and Reality Composer. I talked about those on my reports before DubDub. I think it was on the developer story post that they were announcing a new framework for AR and a new app that you can use to compose AR content. When I heard about those, the framework RealityKit and the app Reality Composer, they had more features than what they came out with. And
yeah,
those features were related to some new hardware stuff.
Yeah, there you go. So probably like there's a new version in the works, like a 2.0 with support for the glasses or something like that.
Yeah, so the glasses are coming.
Glasses are coming.
Yeah.
That's exciting. So I want to go back a little bit, like rewind the tape a little bit back to those tiles that you were talking about earlier. So the fact that you will be able to find any kind of tile using Apple's infrastructure. I wanted to ask you, because this year they released a new feature which enables you to find your Mac even if it's actually turned off, because it will communicate with nearby devices via Bluetooth, or maybe if it's not turned off, but not on the Wi-Fi. So it won't be able to report its location to the server itself, but it's able to communicate with other Apple devices anonymously, and those Apple devices will report the location. So it's like Apple is forming their own gigantic mesh network.
It's called the Find Network.
The Find Network, nice. You think that this is a kind of an initial play to support this tile device later as well?
I would say so, because this device has to be extremely low power, And of course, it can't have its own GPS. That would be crazy. And it doesn't have cellular.
It doesn't run iOS.
Yeah, maybe. We
Apple don't know. Tile runs OS 10.
Tag OS.
Yeah.
Because it's got everything we need.
Exactly.
We always have to make that reference.
We do, yeah.
So the way we heard about how this Fi network works is that your device is sending out a Bluetooth beacon that it's basically just an identifier, and it's all encrypted using a key that only you have access to because it's tied to your iCloud account. So other Apple devices from any person will capture this beacon, and then they can tell Apple servers in an encrypted form, this device with this blob here is near this particular location. And then Apple knows that this ID corresponds to your account, so they send that to your account, and your device can decrypt that information because it's your device and it has the same key. So it makes sense. And this, I know that this tag device goes through a pairing process that's similar to AirPods. So it is tied to your iCloud account as well. So yeah, so basically it's probably using the same mechanism. So this device is using only the offline tracking mechanism.
Cool. I think when we speculated about this device on previous episodes, we were kind of a little bit under the impression, or we made the assumption, that the person who finds it would like approach it with their device and get some button to press to send off this information to the actual owner. But now I'm thinking, like you also, I think that this will just use this system where there's no other user who needs to take any action. They are just like walking by. They might not even have found your car keys that is in someone's couch or something. They're just walking by, and their device then anonymously and automatically reports that location back to Apple servers.
There are both, I believe. Yeah, you won't be like getting notifications all the time. Oh, there's this object.
There's car keys nearby. Yeah. There's gold here. Loot to be found.
Yeah, but the device has a lost mode. So you can put like your car keys in lost mode. And I believe if you do that and someone actually finds them, they can bring up a UI on their iPhone that's going to show you them your contact information. If they want to actually be proactive and contact you, hey, I found your car keys. So I do believe there is also that component that someone can find your item and contact you about your lost item.
Cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing more about this, and I'm sure you're going to find more things as future betas come out and we get closer to September, where we might be seeing this new device.
Yeah, the spelunking I've done has been very minimal so far.
Yeah.
Because I haven't had time. So
only plain spelunking, right?
Yeah, only minor spelunking. So we'll see. I'll probably find some more stuff in there.
Cool. So before we wrap up today, I wanted to ask you, you are running all the new betas, right? You have installed Catalina, you have iOS 13. Do you also have watchOS 6?
I have a confession to make, John.
Oh, you do? Oh, why? Did you buy a new Apple Watch?
I did.
We're getting very close now to, we're going to have to hold some kind of intervention for you, Rambo.
Yeah. So I bought another Apple Watch. I bought the smaller version, which I don't remember which number it is, 30, whatever, 40. So I have this iPhone XR, which is my main test device. It's running iOS 13, and I paired the new Apple Watch with watchOS 6 to this device that's running iOS 13, so I can be alternating between like my stable setup, which is the XS Max and the Series 4 Apple Watch that I got back from Apple because it's been resuscitated, my bricked Apple Watch. Remember that one?
Oh yeah, I do. It got some watch CPR.
Exactly. So it's back to life now, and I'm using it as my main watch, and it's of course on the stable software. My main phone is on stable software. So I have both sets of devices. And the current betas, they are quite rough. They are not very good. I don't recommend using them.
Yeah, it seems to be one of these years where Apple makes like a pretty big technological leap. And it's easy when you look at the things from WWDC to just look at Swift UI combine and these new frameworks. But look at all the things. Like, this is an incredible WWDC. Like, there's
the major springboard refactor.
Right. There's been just a huge amount of things, like, across everything. So I'm not surprised that the betas are a bit rough, because when you do these kind of big changes at once, it usually comes with some stability issues.
Yeah, and just to mention some, and I'm not complaining, I'm just listing them here so people are aware, like my AirPods, my iOS 13 devices, they keep stealing my AirPods from other devices.
My AirPods, give them to me, they're mine.
Yeah, so I will be listening to something on my iPhone XS Max on iOS, the latest iOS 12 stable release, and all of a sudden it's going to stop and it's going to do the doo-doo sound, and I'll look and it's now connected to my iOS 13 iPhone. So that's quite rough. I also have my iPad on iOS 13, and the first thing I did when it booted was, of course, to do the little swipe to show the notification, the widgets, and it crashed. The entire device when I did that the first time. So, I don't recommend it. And Pages on my Mac won't launch with our shared show notes. So I had to use my iPhone to look at the show notes today. So, yeah, that's why they are betas. Beta means better than nothing. They are better than nothing.
That's true. And that's also why we have this great teamwork, you and I. I am sitting here in comfortable Mojave land running all the stable software, and you are in Crazy Town running all the new latest betas. Or maybe it's not Crazy Town, maybe it's just more, you know, Excitement Town.
Yeah, so the takeaway is that I have backups. I have another Mac that's on the latest Mojave. I have my main iPhone, which is on the latest stable iOS. And I have my main Apple Watch that's on the latest watchOS 6. If I didn't have those safeguards, I wouldn't be doing this. I didn't do this last year. Last year, I didn't run the Mojave beta on my... I had it on an external SSD last year. I would do the same. And yeah, I definitely do not recommend, if you only have one device, keep it on stable software.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Always having some redundancy is good in these situations. So what's your impressions of iPad OS? Like, have you been playing around with it more since it crashed there? Or you just said, oh, no, that's it. I can't do this.
Oh, this iPad thing doesn't work. Throw it out the window.
Right. Buy a new one, right?
I actually bought an iPad on my trip.
Of course.
But it's not for me. So it's been doing great. Yeah, one thing I really love about running iPadOS and running Catalina is being able to use Sidecar, which, as I mentioned, works beautifully. So I've been playing around with using Sidecar. I've always been a one-monitor person, but using Sidecar has been quite good for me because I can have two really beautiful Retina displays at my disposal, and that's really cool. By the way, a tip. I've heard many people had trouble with Sidecar working. I haven't been able to make it work wired yet. So
that's, I see.
It's kind of counterintuitive. You think wired is more reliable than wireless, but yeah, it works for me wirelessly and it works very well, but it doesn't work wired. So if you've been trying wired thinking it's more reliable than wireless, try wireless. I've been using Sidecar and been trying out the new multi-window apps like Notes and Safari. By the way, Safari is awesome on iPadOS. You can now use Google Docs, John, on iPadOS.
What Safari. A revolution.
That's
it's amazing.
Revolutionary. Yeah. So that works. WhatsApp Web also works. I know it's not big in other countries, but in Brazil, WhatsApp, it's kind of huge. And they don't have an iPad app. They don't have a Mac app. You have to use third-party apps if you want to. But they have this web thing that you sync with your iPhone, and it works now on iPadOS, which is great. It didn't work before. So, yeah, iPadOS, thumbs up so far.
Awesome. What I really love about like desktop class Safari on the iPad is that the web browser, in so many cases on the Mac, acts as this like escape hatch. Like, you just mentioned that WhatsApp doesn't have an iPad app. Well, now you can go to Safari and get a decent experience, you can at least do what you need to get done. And that escape hatch, that like web escape hatch, is so great to have, because I don't like the fact that you always need to have a native app to do anything, because not, you don't always want to install a native app to do something. You might just want to access a service once or twice, or you can't do what you want to do with that native app. Like Google Docs is a great example where the native apps are kind of stripped down versions of what you get on the web. So having that desktop class Safari, and by all accounts, it really seems like you did a great job on it. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, some people have been making fun of the fact that iCloud.com doesn't work on iPadOS.
That's
but
funny.
But I don't think that's fair. I think that's very much on purpose, because there's no point to accessing iCloud.com on iOS. It doesn't make sense, because you have all the native apps right there. And in the case of iCloud.com, the web version is a stripped-down version of what you get on apps that are all of them, at least most of them, built into iOS. So yeah, I don't think that's fair to make fun of iCloud.com not working. But I'm sure they could flip a bit in their config file and make it work on iPadOS.
Right. But it is funny. It's almost like there was a time when some emails from Apple, like some marketing emails, didn't render on the Apple Watch. And that was also kind of funny, right? Because it was like, here, you've got an email from Apple. Apple Watch cannot display this email. You know, it just seems funny. And I totally understand, and I get your point. And I'm sure also at some point they will make it work, because it's still very early and there seems to be some manual work involved in actually writing some kind of translation layer or some kind of instructions for the browser. So I'm sure we'll get there someday.
Yeah, I should also try out App Store Connect on iPadOS.
That would be funny, because that's also a very like JavaScript heavy web app, right?
And it's super bad on iOS currently.
Right. Yeah, that'd be cool. So yeah, try more websites and report to us what you find. Maybe the Rambo report next week will be the web report or the Safari report.
Sites that work on iPad now.
Exactly. That could be a new podcast. Sites that work. Welcome to Sites That Work on iPad. All right, so we've gone now for a while, so it's time to say goodbye and to end this episode. We just want to say that we want to talk a lot more about WWDC in the coming weeks and months, and we'd love to hear what you think. Like, what do you want us to talk about? So do send us hashtag AskStackTrace questions. We know we already got some. We will start answering them on the next episode, so next week. And in general, like, feel free to send us feedback on Twitter. We love to see people share the show and share clips from Overcast of some funny things or something you found interesting. Please do that, because it really helps the show, and it also gives us great feedback on what kind of segments that you enjoyed of this episode. But that's it for this episode. So all that remains is for us to thank our great sponsors at Whip Labs for supporting this episode and for making it possible. And you can, of course, find both me and Rambo on Twitter. I am at John Sundell. Rambo is at _inside. And Rambo writes at 9to5mac.com. And I write at swiftbysundell.com. You can also check out wwcbysundell.com if you want to catch up on the news there. But that's it for this episode, so say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.